Bet365 is paying out before the final whistle.
Check out Bet365's unrivaled early payout offer. When you bet on a team to win and they take a 17-point lead, you get paid no matter the final score. Forget the final whistle and start counting that cash. Hold up. You get early payout on parlays, too.
Download the app and see why it's never ordinary at Bet365. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. 21 plus only. Must be physically located in Ohio. T&Cs apply.
Not coming from Brent Veach and Andy Reid, and it's not coming from Sean McVay. It's coming from the Cleveland Browns. And yeah. You're seeing exactly
you know
what
why
people
it's not,
outside of Cleveland
you know,
think of the Browns, outside of Browns.
You know
fans.
Why it's not coming from those guys? Because they didn't draft him. They didn't want him to begin with. This was the one team that wanted him, and they're telling you he's behind. Maybe it's not a grand conspiracy. Maybe everybody is right, and the Shador fans, you wackos. Maybe it's your guy is just not ready. Maybe you got to come to grips with it.
The Ken Carmen Show with Anthony Lima on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and wherever you get your podcasts.
You're listening to the Dana and Parks podcast on KMBZ.
Wait, what now?
Oh, that's one of my favorite clips from a couple of months ago where an individual, I can't remember what state it was in, but was driving by a couple of police cruisers and decided to give them the California howdy, the one finger salute, whatever you want to call it.
The single deuce.
And they pulled him over for it and issued him a ticket. And that was the body cam footage of them interrogating him about his improper hand signal.
Improper hand display. That's fantastic. Yeah, by the way, that is constitutionally protected. So, yeah, I don't think that ticket's probably going to stand. Although, you know, this day and age, who knows? Dan Weinbaum is also hanging around. How are you, buddy?
I'm good. How are you?
Great. And now, because of you, extraordinarily nostalgic. Rocky Horror. All right.
Yes.
I didn't know that the 50th anniversary was nigh, so thank you for that. But you also had that lilt in your voice when you said, the midnight movies. Yeah. I cannot count how many Saturday nights or Friday nights or Saturday nights, because that's usually when they did them.
Right.
I sat there at the AMC Theater's Midnight Movie Express to see Rocky Horror. And what they did, because I was in Tampa at the time, what they did at a lot of the AMC theaters that we used to go to watch it is they would do a double feature. So it was Rocky Horror at midnight and then. And it was always something bizarre, like Eraserhead or
right.
The Three Amigos or you know, whatever.
Yeah,
just
some kind of cheap horror movie.
Yeah, and I mean, it was so much fun. And I don't know if it was just the kind of waning nature of the desire of people to go to movie theaters at all, or just a decision that AMC made that was like, yeah, we've done this enough. But it was always fun. There was one theater that we went to, yeah, at University Square Mall in Tampa, where they had a live cast acting out the movie in front of the movie. So
right.
It was like, meta wasn't even a phrase then, but it was so completely meta. <You know? laughs> it was so much fun. Did you go to those a lot?
Oh, I went to the midnight movies all the time when I was in high school and I could drive myself and there was nothing else to do in Columbia, South Carolina, but get in trouble or go to the midnight movies. So,
and since you're not a troublemaker, so. You know.
Well, you know, we all change. Yeah, I used to go see the Rocky Horror Picture Show all the time. And you sing along and you shout out all the callbacks and people are dressed up and you have all of your the accoutrement, if you will, to play along. And it's just so much fun.
Well, and the callbacks, I mean, for people who've never had this experience, it's impossible to describe. But yeah, you sit in the audience and there is a script that you talk back to the movie. It's almost a kind of a weird Mystery Science Theater 3000-esque thing.
Uh-huh.
And over time, that script evolved because one of the riffs was at the very beginning of the movie, they put up that slate, the old RKO radio pictures, and one of the lines that you shout at the screen is, "What the F is a radio picture?" And over time, that evolved because by the mid-80s, people were then shouting back, "MTV, dumb blank." So,
well,
was,
you know, when it came out, 1975, the audiences and the people of the time, they knew what that was from just 15, 20, 25 years prior. But then now here we are in the 21st century and it is anachronistic.
Right. And now, I mean, and everybody in that movie, it was so perfectly cast. I mean, you know, you mentioned Barry Bostwick, Susan Sarandon, and I mean,
Janet. Yes,
them as the couple, as Brad and Janet, because they look like Barbie and Ken, you know? So it was like, of course they were perfect for that because they were so squeaky clean. And then all of a sudden they end up at Dr. Frankenfurter's castle and the whole thing gets crazy.
Such an oddball movie, very camp.
Yes.
And the characters and just the whole storyline was just ludicrous, of course, but set to an amazing soundtrack.
Yes.
And the songs are so good.
Yeah, and yeah, they really are. I mean, think about the time warp, right? How much fun is that to listen to? And even though, I mean, the singing on behalf of Magenta and Columbia, they mm-hmm. they could sing. They were actually singers.
Yeah,
the guy who played right, and the guy who played Riff Raff really wasn't, but that kind of made that song even better. It just
he's the one that wrote the thing and wrote all the music and the lyrics and everything.
Yep. So yeah, just so much fun. And I mean, it's an experience. It's one of those things that we had that is never going to be recreated because, you know, nobody's going to sit in their house watching the big screen, watching Rocky Horror, yelling at their TV.
Some people might.
Well, yeah, that's true. There are some hardcores out there. But
what's interesting about this is that it started as, you know, this low budget movie, the independent comedy horror musical. And then, of course, it spawned all the stuff we've been talking about. But then it moved on stage.
Yes.
And so you have stage plays all over the country where you can go and attend and watch this play out on stage. You can even dress up. I've been known to do that.
Now, which character?
Frankenfurter, of course.
Of course. Mm-hmm. The only time, and this was, again, another Tampa reference, in my early radio career, there's a famous old theater in downtown Tampa called the Tampa Theater, and I think it opened in like 1921 or 22. Beautiful old theater, 1,500 seats, and they did Rocky Horror on a Friday night. And they asked me and the talk show host that I was working with at the time and a couple of other people from the radio station, because we had a really good relationship with them, if we would come down in character and introduce the movie.
Oh, very cool.
And for some reason, Brian James, who was the talk show host that was there, he dressed up as Dr. Frankenfurter. Somehow I ended up as Magenta.
Oh, nice.
So there is a picture out there on the internet somewhere of me dressed up in drag as Magenta at Rocky Horror. And it's as horrifying as you would think. It really is. I had 3 days growth of beard going.
It's all fun. Oh yeah. It's just
yes,
fun.
Indeed. So they're doing they're having a like a tour of this thing for the 50th anniversary.
With original cast members, it's a 55 date tour to mark the 50th anniversary. And in fact, here in Kansas City, they have the Rocky Horror Picture Show live on stage down at Crown Center all month, as they have been doing each year for the past several.
Uh huh.
Yeah, and good stuff.
Love it. Yeah. To give you one more little thing here, because years ago, I was talking with a friend of mine who's a TV critic, and the new season of Spin City had just come out. And Barry Bostwick from Rocky Horror was in later episodes of that show. He was, I believe, the mayor or something like that. And so this TV critic that I know had a chance to go to one of the junkets and sit down and have a conversation. In fact, he ended up having dinner with Barry Bostwick. And he asked him, because if you watch episodes of Spin City, you'll see Barry Bostwick still has that incredible head of hair.
Oh, yeah.
And so my buddy asked him, he said, how is it that, you know, we're all old and fat and bald now, and you still look great, and you've got all of that hair? And Bostwick, without missing a beat, just looked at him and said, Propecia. So, yeah, you get a little bit of help now and again.
Definitely.
But it's all good. Dan Weinbaum, thank you so much, and we'll talk again soon. We've got plenty more coming up. In just a little bit, we're going to hear from, of all people, Montel Williams. He's got a new book out about World War II. Of course, he's got a wonderful service record himself as a member not only of the U.S. Navy, but also the U.S. Marines, and wrote a book called The Sailing of the Intrepid, The Incredible Wartime Voyage of the Navy's Iconic Aircraft Carrier. So we'll hear from Montel in just a little bit. Stick with us. John Grayson here with you, enjoying a Thursday on KMBZ.
Bet365 is paying out before the final whistle.
Check out Bet365's unrivaled early payout offer. When you bet on a team to win and they take a 17-point lead, you get paid no matter the final score. Forget the final whistle and start counting that cash. Hold up. You get early payout on parlays, too.
Download the app and see why it's never ordinary at Bet365. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. 21 plus only. Must be physically located in Ohio. T&Cs apply.
Not coming from Brent Veach and Andy Reid, and it's not coming from Sean McVay. It's coming from the Cleveland Browns. And yeah. You're seeing exactly
you know
what
why
people
it's not,
outside of Cleveland think of the Browns, outside of
you
Browns.
You know why
fans.
It's not coming from those guys? Because they didn't draft him. They didn't want him to begin with. This was the one team that wanted him, and they're telling you he's behind. Maybe it's not a grand conspiracy. Maybe everybody is right, and the Shador fans, you wackos. Maybe it's your guy is just not ready. Maybe you got to come to grips with it.
The Ken Carmen Show with Anthony Lima on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and wherever you get your podcasts.
John Grayson in for Dana and Parks, and very, very pleased to bring in our next guest on the broadcast, our first guest on the broadcast for today. You know him, of course, as a longtime talk show host, also a 22-year veteran of the Navy and the Marine Corps, and a man with a brand new book out called The Sailing of the Intrepid, the incredible wartime voyage of the Navy's iconic aircraft carrier, Montel Williams. Welcome to KMBZ. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me, sir.
Absolutely. And this story is incredibly compelling. The book is incredibly well written. But I have to know, they're not called the greatest generation for nothing. I mean, there are so many stories of heroism and these amazing men who did such over-the-top things during World War II. Why was the story of the Intrepid the one you wanted to tell?
It's so important because we live in a time right now where, you know, we have so many people who are so fractionated in the country, and we are divided in so many ways. You look back at a time like this where 3,000 men came together on a 300-foot ship. A 900-foot ship, almost three full football fields long, and were determined to make sure that even though they knew they had taken a blow that literally could have been the most catastrophic blow they had ever taken, they came together to figure out a way to save the ship and to get it back 3,000 miles so it could be repaired and back into the fight. Why? Because they wanted to make sure that the Japanese didn't have this as some sort of a bragging right that they had sunk one of the most powerful ships that the U.S. Navy had. But they also understood its need and its capability and what it would be needed for future conflicts in that same war. So I really, you know, was just compelled by the story of the fact that, you know, the captain, who was just a genius of his own right, Captain Sprague, relied upon the input of his entire crew. As many people that could give him input, gave him input and said, you know, sir, if we were to take a sail relying on the oldest technology of maritime service and attach it to the most modern ship in the world, we might be able to make this thing go straight. And he said, let's give it a shot. And they gave it a shot, and guess what? It worked. They were able to make this ship go straight over 3,000 miles back to Hawaii to be refit and get back into the battle. Yes. And then once it got back into the battle, it got hit by two kamikazes. Went back into dry dock, went back into battle, got hit by three kamikazes. Went back into dry dock, back into the battle, and then went on and served heroically throughout the rest of World War II, Korean War, Vietnam War, went on to become, you know, the recovery ship for the space program before it was set to be retired. And but for Zachary Fisher, who decided that this ship's history is too rife with just heroism that goes beyond anything that we've ever seen, we need to save it. He decided to buy it himself and then convince Mayor Koch to put it along the West Side Highway and turn it into the air, space, and Navy and Sea Museum that it is today.
Yeah, and I mean, that story of the first two battles, and we'll talk about Tom Sprague here in just a second as well, but the first two battles were incredible successes, and then followed by that massive damage that was done to the ship by one plane. Tell a little bit of that story about what happened.
One plane, one torpedo. Let me tell you, they had just, what people don't understand is that it had successfully completed a battle in Kwajalein, which is part of the Marshall Islands, and they just delivered devastating tonnage worth of damage to the Japanese, went on to Truk Island and completely flattened it. And those were the two of the most devastating blows that we hit against them in that early part of the war. and it was leaving the truck harbor. And, you know, because of the trail that it left in the water, there was a single lone Japanese pilot that was able to track the plane, track the carrier down, launch the torpedo. And guess what? Some of the guys on the ship, on the Intrepid, actually said that once he dropped the torpedo, he flew right over the deck and they were able to see his face. That's how close he was. It was only 30, 40 feet above the aircraft carrier. And then all of a sudden it gets rocked and got rocked a bit with a torpedo that was big enough that it cut a hole in the aft portion of the ship from sea level all the way up to the flight deck. There were multiple deaths, but these guys would not give up. Pinning the rudder 45 degrees made it careen out of control. It almost hit the USS Essex, one of the other aircraft carriers of the same class, missed it by only meters, not tens of meters, meters. And that would have been one of the most devastating nautical accidents of all time.
Yeah, right. And one of the things you did that I thought was incredible is you took us through. I think a lot of us think, okay, a ship is christened and then boom, off to war it goes. No, it was 7 months in between. And it turns out that while they were putting her through her paces, the one thing they didn't train for because they thought it was so unlikely was getting hit in the rudder. And that's what happened to them.
They did, but guess what? When they pulled out in the Atlantic, Captain Sprague did do one damage control training session just in case, and they were using the engines to see if he could control the ship with the engines, not the rudder. And so they practiced it. But that was one of the things that was so impressive about Captain Sprague. He understood the need to practice and train. So they were always training, you know, in battle stations, making sure that the watertight compartments were closed. This ship really set the standard for damage control for the rest of the United States Navy and the rest of the world, because people had understood this same fate fell upon the Bismarck, which was one of the largest German ships ever built. And also it was the reason why the Yorktown was sunk, another aircraft carrier of its same class. Both of them hitting a rudder, and both of those rudders pinned in one or the other direction, forward or starboard, but making them careen out of control. So it was the fact that forethought and training and training and training is what helped save those men, save their lives.
The book is The Sailing of the Intrepid. Montel Williams, its author, here with us. And so let's get to Tom Sprague because, I mean, as you said, he was a guy who wanted to be a pilot. He wanted to be a flyer. And this was his first duty as the captain of a ship. And these are the things he has to deal with. What kind of man are we talking about here who was able to pull all of this off?
We're talking about a young man who grew up maybe about 4 or 5 miles away from Kitty Hawk. So his dream as a child was to do what those Wright brother guys did. But he recognized the fact that they weren't really the first. And that's something that we cover in this book that a lot of people don't know. We think the Wright brothers were the first to fly a plane with a motor. They really weren't. It was a guy by the name of Professor Samuel Langley who put together a test to see if a plane could actually take off from the deck of a ship. And at the time, Langley was the director of the Smithsonian Institute. He put together a plane that was called the Buzzard. And in the Potomac River, they flew that plane off the Buzzard. They flew the Buzzard off of a plane, which proved that an airplane could fly off the deck of the ship. It took them another year or two to figure out that they could land on one. And once they figured that out, and so his whole life, he grew up wanting to fly, and kept getting turned down because he was such a good naval officer. And they didn't want to lose him. Because most navies in the world didn't believe that aircraft carriers would be worth their salt, and he proved them wrong.
Yeah, and it's like we said, it's just an incredibly compelling story. And if you are of interest in U.S. history at all, especially World War II history, this is a story that you have to know. And it's told brilliantly by Montel Williams in The Sailing of the Intrepid. And by the way, here we are in Buffalo, and the USS The Sullivans, which is docked right out here on the lake, is part of this story. And you can find out about that inside the book as well. Montel Williams, such a pleasure talking to you, my friend. Thank you so much for giving us the book. And when are we going to see you on TV again?
Oh, you know, I'm on TV every Friday morning on a show that's called Military Makeover. We take deserving veterans and we make their homes over from the ground up. We show you the whole makeover, but we also sit down with the family and talk to them. So you can catch me right there. Okay.
Excellent. And thank you, sir, for not only the book, but for your service in the U.S. Marines and the U.S. Navy. Always a pleasure. Montel Williams, thank you so much.
Thank you, sir. You take care.
You do the same. And we'll do some more talking just after the bottom of the hour. Stay with us. John Grayson here with you on KMBZ. It never fails, Sam. I cannot hear this song without thinking about Eric Cartman singing it. I just can't.
I have not seen that episode, but I'll have to check it out.
Oh, you got it. It's amazing. Yeah, John Grayson in for Dana and Parks on this Thursday afternoon. And Sam, a couple of things. You said we got a text a little while ago from somebody on the text line in response to our chat with Montel Williams.
Yeah.
What did we get?
So he was talking about a ship that had to make makeshift sails to get back after losing power. They had said there was actually another vessel that had to do that as well, also sailing back to Hawaii. In May of 1921, submarine R-14 was starting to run out of fuel and losing radio communication because they didn't have any power to power their radios. And so they surfaced that bad boy and took a bunch of blankets and hammocks and made sails on top of the submarine and sailed what took several days at roughly 2 knots to make it all the way to Hawaii.
And see, that's the thing about the Intrepid is that, I mean, it was in the middle of a war.
Yeah.
1921, you know, there's no war going on. World War I's already over with, and so they were just out on maneuvers and had to do it, which is incredible enough. I mean, I'm not taking anything away from what they did, but the Intrepid had to make that trip. Now, granted, they still had power, so I'm sure they were going a lot faster than two knots. Yeah, but still, not being able to steer is a bit of a hindrance. So, yeah, for them to do that in the middle of a war when, I mean, as crippled as that ship was at that point, if another Japanese ship or Japanese aircraft had found that ship, it's over.
Oh, you're done. Absolutely. Yeah. It's very different because a war is not going on, but this is still incredible that you have a bunch of guys on top of a submarine in, you know, the middle of the Pacific where there's nothing for hundreds and thousands of miles. Oh, we're going to go 2 knots. We'll see you in May.
Well, it also makes you appreciate what Captain Bligh did. Did you ever see any of this stuff about the Bounty?
No.
The mutiny on the Bounty?
Uh-uh.
When they mutinied, when Fletcher Christian took over the Bounty and sent Captain Bligh and set him adrift in a dinghy, they were in the South Pacific, and he somehow managed to sail that dinghy back to Europe with food. Yeah, no food, no water, no nothing. And if I remember right, they ended up, was it Holland? I don't remember, and I don't want to screw it up. But yeah, he was able to navigate by the stars with no sextant, no, you know, nothing. He had, I think, Christian left him a telescope.
Okay.
And that was really it. And he was able to navigate by the stars and get back to Europe.
Wow, that is incredible. A whole lot of raw fish and dead bird.
Yeah, and you know the movie that was made. There have been several cracks at Mutiny on the Bounty, but there was one that came out in the early 80s that was just called The Bounty, and it was Anthony Hopkins played Captain Bligh, and I don't know where my brain is right now. I can't remember his name. The American actor who everybody thinks is Australian. From The Road Warrior and.
I have no idea.
He's only one of the biggest actors ever. Got in trouble for saying Jews, you know, start all the wars in the world and all this. He gets drunk and yells at cops every so often and gets himself all crossed up. But yeah, he played Fletcher Christian. It's not a great movie, but it does tell the story pretty well, so it's worth it. If you are not familiar with that, it's not a bad place to start. Mel Gibson,
good God. We're really good at trivia on this show.
Yeah, I know.
Wow.
I don't know where that name went, but it just flew right out of my head. I hate it when that happens.
You had a lot of random facts about him locked up and ready to go.
Yep. Well, you know, that's what I do.
Uh-huh.
So that happened. But a couple of other things. You also, Sam Stevie.
Yes.
Are a bit of an outdoorsman.
Yes.
You like going walking in the woods.
Oh, I do. I love it.
I do not. I know you go up to the UP, right?
Every year. Yep.
And just how long are you out there? You do a week?
We try to do a week. If we can get 10 days, we'll get 10 days. But it's really just up to the schedule of how long we can both get up there. My longtime best friend and former roommate is who I go with. Yeah.
Gotcha. Okay. And see, I mean, I'll go to a park or something like a big national park and ooh and ah for a couple of hours. And then I'll
right
go
back
home.
Into the AC.
Exactly, right. Or here into the heat. this is the reason why I don't do that stuff. There was a woman who is only known by her surname Chin, who is in the Guangzhou province in near Guangzhou, which is a big city in China. But she was out in a kind of a wooded area, just hiking, you know, just doing her thing out there in the woods, communing with nature like you do, and fell into a disused well.
Oh, she couldn't see that well, huh?
Yeah, apparently not. It may have been dark. I don't know. But either way, she fell into this disused well. And, I mean, it's the middle of the woods. There's nobody around. Apparently, she didn't tell her family where she was going to be or where she was going hiking. She just went out for a walk in the woods and fell into this well. And they said that she was in that well. Now, I'll save you the heartburn on this by telling you she's fine. Okay, she wasn't for a while, but she's fine.
She made it out alive.
She was in that well for 54 hours, more than 2 days, and the well was full. I mean, you know, not full, but there was water there, so she was in the water.
Oh, my gosh.
And she said she had to cling onto the side of this stone well, and she pulled out. She eventually pulled out a couple of stones that were under the water line,
yeah,
as footholds,
okay,
so that she could. And she couldn't sleep. Obviously, you sleep, you fall back, and you know that's
you're done.
Bad.
Yeah,
right. So she was up for 54 hours straight, and inside the well, because it's standing water. And what do they always tell you about standing water?
Bacteria. Mosquitoes. Oh, mosquitoes.
And,
yeah,
mosquitoes, bacteria, all of that. And to add insult to even more insult to injury. Snakes.
Well, of course.
Eels. I mean, all kinds of stuff swimming around in there with her. Now, she said the one saving grace, because she was bitten by one of the snakes, is that the snakes that were in the well were not venomous.
Oh, good.
So, but still, yeah. I mean, of all places to get stuck, you're in a well trying to hold on to the sides of this thing. And she didn't, I mean, obviously didn't know if anybody was going to come looking for her. Nobody really had any idea where she was. They sent out a thermal imaging drone and were doing a search that way, and had teams that were just canvassing the area looking for any sign of life from this woman at all, because her family eventually did report her missing.
Well, and with that thermal imaging, they would have to fly exactly over the well to be able to see it, because you're not going to see it from an angle because she's down deep into the dirt.
Exactly. And since it was, I mean, the well had been shut down, it was no longer used. So I'm sure it's not on any maps anywhere, you know,
and
that
she
there's
couldn't
even
drink
a well
the
there.
Water. Oh, my gosh, that's horrifying.
Right. So
the conversations about what would be the worst way to die, not to take this a weird direction, but, you know, you're down there and you're like, what? Make it end, you know, drowning right. is always in the conversation about the worst way to die.
And she said that there were times, obviously, over the course of that 54 hours when she thought about just giving up. Just
let,
you know,
go. Yeah.
Just doing the Jack at the end of Titanic thing. Uh-huh. Just let go and down you go. But she said it was the thoughts of her family that kept her going.
Aww.
That she couldn't, you know, she thought about her mom and leaving her mom alone, and she didn't want to do that. And that just buoyed her literally and figuratively in that water. And they said that one of the teams that was out there taking part in the search heard faint screams for help. And how they ended up finding her. So
and
even
she still had a voice to scream 54 hours later.
Yep. Get this. They said after her rescue, she was transferred first to Jinjiang City Hospital and later to Guangzhou First Hospital. Doctors diagnosed her with two fractured ribs that I'm assuming she got during the fall.
Yeah, of course.
A minor collapsed lung, severe injuries to her hands because she's gripping onto the wall. I mean, not to take it in a really dark direction, but remember the fingernails scene from Silence of the Lambs. Ugh. So,
and not to mention when you're submerged in water like that, the hands start to prune and your skin is much softer and tears a whole lot easier.
I will tell you a story about that in just a second. But so two fractured ribs, minor collapsed lung, severe injuries to the hands. And she said there were countless times I wanted to give up. But then I thought about my 70-year-old mother, my 80-year-old father, and my daughter who just started college. If I left them behind, what would they do? So she somehow garnered the strength to keep that going and made it out alive. And what I was thinking about is, yeah, you mentioned the worst ways to die thing. Have you ever been trapped somewhere?
I'm claustrophobic. I'm a large person. Small spaces don't cut it for me. If I were to fall in that well, I would thankfully probably be lucky enough to reach both sides, but I would have climbed out long before the 54-hour mark. Otherwise, I would have lost my marbles. You would have rescued me and sent me straight to an inpatient facility for mental health concerns.
I have been trapped in an elevator twice. Now, granted, there were no snakes in there and it wasn't full of water, so I'm not trying to compare. I'm not trying to compare what happened to me to what happened to her. But yeah, and it was the same elevator that I got trapped in twice. And you know, when it happens, it's not like, I mean, you ride elevators, right? So it's not like you immediately go, bah, you know, bonkers. And I don't suffer from the same sort of claustrophobia that you do.
Yeah.
But yeah, I mean, when the elevator stops and the doors don't open, it's so unsettling because you start to think, okay, well, and the crazy part about the first time I got stuck in that elevator is I was 5 minutes away from having to be on the air.
Oh, good. Yeah, good.
Yeah.
Very like, important.
Okay, somebody needs to come and get me out of this elevator like right now, or there's not going to be any show. And they did. But yeah, the second time I was in there for a good half hour before I could raise anybody to come and get me.
You live from the building's elevator. I'm John right. Grayson.
Somebody's going to have to find a really long microphone cable and just drop that thing down through the hole in the ceiling. It was weird, but you just think about being trapped somewhere like that where you're not sure, because I never had any illusions that I was never going to make it out of that elevator. You know, I knew I was eventually going to get out. But
I will say that elevators don't give me the claustrophobia that other smaller spaces do, because I, too, have been trapped in an elevator. I had to climb. It was the trapped situation where you were halfway between the floors.
Yep.
And the fireman came and pried the door open, and he was like, all right, climb out quick, because we don't know when this thing's dropping. I'm like, oh, great, thanks. I think I'll just stay here and avoid the potentiality of getting chopped in half. Thank you.
Well, here's the good news about that, is that elevators, I know it's a common, you know, sort of trope in movies and things like that. Elevators can't plummet.
Oh, good. So he was just messing with me?
Yeah, he was playing around. But yeah, they have past a certain date. I mean, and I don't know when it was, but it was like mid 20th century. It became law that all elevators have to have an automatic braking system on them, so that even if the cables snap, the thing automatically just shoves these things out to the side along the track and it can't go down.
Well, no one told Hollywood that.
I know. Well, the exception to that, oddly enough, is the Empire State Building. Back in the waning days of World War II, 1944, maybe early 1945, there was a light heavy bomber, I think it was a B-25, that hit the Empire State Building. It was dense fog, they couldn't see where they were going, and they smashed into the Empire State Building, and one of the engines went into the elevator shaft and landed on top of the elevator. And the weight of that engine drove the elevator all the way down. And there were two women in the elevator. They both survived. I think one of them had broken legs. Maybe they both did. But yeah, it was just a completely bizarre situation. I didn't even know for the longest time that the Empire State Building had ever been hit by a plane.
That's incredible. Yeah, neither did I.
But, needless to say, I don't think anybody on the plane made it.
Talk about a story to tell for the rest of your life.
No kidding.
Well, I was one of the two ladies in the elevator.
Yeah, I wonder whatever became of them. Can you imagine that radio interview?
Right. Go on a speaking circuit, because that story, I mean, you can't write it.
No doubt. We'll do some more talking just ahead. Wind up the hour, and we got plenty more on the way for you as this Thursday afternoon continues. John Grayson in for Dana and Parks.
Listen up, football fans. You won't want to miss this.
Right now, new Bet365 customers bet $5 and get $200 in bonus bets, win or lose. So you could turn that $200 into something bigger when you bet on Moneyline, spread, totals, player props.
$200 in bonus bets when new customers bet $5. I know where I'm going to bet from now on. Download the app today and see why it's never ordinary at Bet365. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. 21 plus only. Must be physically located in Ohio. T&Cs apply. In app only.
It's not coming from Brent Veach and Andy Reid, and it's not coming from Sean McVay. It's coming from the Cleveland Browns. And yeah. You're seeing exactly you know what why people it's not, outside of Cleveland you know, think of the Browns, outside of Browns.
You know why
fans.
It's not coming from those guys? Because they didn't draft him. They didn't want him to begin with. This was the one team that wanted him, and they're telling you he's behind. Maybe it's not a grand conspiracy. Maybe everybody is right, and the Shador fans, you wackos.
Maybe it's your guy is just not ready.
maybe you got to come to grips with it.
The Ken Carmen Show with Anthony Lima on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and wherever you get your podcasts.
John Grayson in for Dana and Parks this afternoon. Having a good time. Sam Stevie alongside, of course, as well. And got a couple of stories here to wind up the hour with. There is a gentleman in Great Britain who is in more than a little bit of trouble. His name is Stuart Kennedy. He's 42 years old and has been a male stripper for nearly 20 years.
Oh, Deuce Bigelow, huh?
I guess. So he's in trouble because he was just convicted. He was found guilty of sexually assaulting a bride-to-be at her bachelorette party.
Wow, dare he.
Which in Great Britain they refer to as a hen party. So, okay, sure. It said that Stuart Kennedy, age 42, was at this particular hen party and was found guilty of sexually assaulting the bride-to-be after jiggling her breasts.
Oh!
So, it seems like you're not supposed to do that. He is now, and here's the great part about this story. This is the second time he's been convicted of sexually assaulting a bride-to-be at her bachelorette party.
Well, what are you going to learn, man? Shake your own moneymaker, not theirs.
He has now been placed on the sex offender registry after the incident at the Prosecco and Pizza Bash at a hotel in Perthshire in Scotland. He was convicted after being found guilty in a similar offense. He was warned that he could end up in jail this time. As the sheriff told the Perth Sheriff Court, "I'm satisfied he did touch her breasts. Her evidence was clear and corroborated." What did he think was going to happen?
Yeah, I mean, you're the show, not them, dude.
Exactly.
22 years, you haven't figured that out yet?
Apparently not. And, I tell you what, we'll save this one for after the top of the hour. We're going to go to, where are we going for this one? We'll get it figured out. Oh, St. Paul. The Twin Cities in Minnesota. It has happened again. Another school bus with another couple of kids who were left on board. We'll bring you the details on that. We'll get into what happened or what may have happened and what's about to happen to a couple of bus drivers up there. Stay with us. Plenty more to come. John Grayson with you in for Dana and Parks. We continue.
Thanks for listening to the Dana and Parks podcast. Remember, you can catch us online anytime at KMBZ.com.
Bet365 is paying out before the final whistle.
Check out Bet365's unrivaled early payout offer. When you bet on a team to win and they take a 17-point lead, you get paid no matter the final score. Forget the final whistle and start counting that cash. Hold up. You get early payout on parlays, too.
Download the app and see why it's never ordinary at Bet365. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. 21 plus only. Must be physically located in Ohio. T&Cs apply.
Kevin Stefanski and Andrew Barry, do you think that they are good at what they do?
Yeah, I think so. Well, Stefanski, two-time coach of the year. Andrew Barry, I don't know. Do we blame the Haslams for the Deshaun Watson debacle?
The questions and the criticisms are more about ownership than anybody on the sideline or in the GM.
He's the head coach of a franchise owned by Jimmy Haslam, so who knows? If you put him in a more stable situation with a less volatile compound in the owner's box, maybe you'd get more.
The Ken Carmen Show with Anthony Lima on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and wherever you get your podcasts.